to everyone, and greetings of love in Jesus' name. Stand before you in fear of God, and I desire that what is shared this morning would be what God would have me to share, not my own agenda. Interesting Sunday school lesson about Jacob wrestling with God. And Jacob was a very impulsive man at times, and he was also very committed. Subject I want to talk about this morning, I think it's good for each one of us to wrestle with in our own mind. And what I plan to share is some of the things I'm wrestling with, and I welcome your input, your discussion, because I think it's important that we understand or know where we are. Last evening when I was studying, right about 8:30, I was seriously regretting volunteering to come up here last minute. So I took David Brousseau's advice. I don't know if any of you have ever read his book, Plain Speaking. It's a very good book on, goes through how to prepare a sermon, how to speak. And of course, he advocates that you start quite a bit of time ahead of time. But he said if you're studying and you get to a roadblock, just stop and you go do something else. So about 8:30, I had a serious headache. And the more I studied, the more confused I got. So I quit, went to bed. About 3 o'clock, I woke up. And suddenly, things looked a lot clearer. So hopefully, as I share this morning, I'll be able to deliver it in a way that makes sense and is not a bunch of jumbled information. To start out, I'd like to tell you a little story. There was a fellow by the name of Louis Zamperini, and he actually wrote a book. I don't know if any of you have read the book Unbroken. Very fascinating story. He was a bombardier in World War II on a B-24 fighter plane, or bomber, actually. And on May 24, 1943, Louis was flying on a B-24 bomber nicknamed the Green Hornet. And this plane crashed into the Pacific Ocean about 850 miles southwest of Oahu, Hawaii, which obviously is out in the Pacific Ocean. The crew was actually on a search and rescue mission looking for another downed plane. Louis and his pilot Phil, or called Russell Phillips, they called him Phil, were from a different crew that normally flew on a B-24 called Superman. Their regular plane had been badly damaged after a combat mission, so while it was being repaired, they temporarily were assigned to the Green Hornet. The Green Hornet's own crew wasn't familiar with Zamperini and Phillips, and many of them had little experience flying together as a team. The Green Hornet itself was a spare bomber, a backup aircraft known around the base for mechanical problems and instability. And I think I'm not sure if it was that particular plane, but they said the B-24, a lot of the airmen called them the flying coffin. Because if you do any reading on those bombers, it was pretty crazy what they endured in combat missions. So when they were sent out on a search and rescue mission on that fateful day, they effectively were a makeshift crew on an unreliable aircraft with limited familiarity and coordination among them, a combination that proved disastrous when mechanical failure struck. While flying over open ocean, one of the engines failed and the plane lost control, crashing into the sea. Of the 11 men on board, only three survived: Louis, Russell Phillips, and Francis McNamara, which they called Mac. They climbed onto two small life rafts, beginning their long drift at sea. They survived by catching rainwater, eating raw fish, birds, and fending off sharks. Early on in the voyage, they made plans to ration out their food, and they took a guess how long they might be on this raft till they're discovered. And they weren't in very far until Mac, one night in desperation, ate all their food. So that was a pretty hard pill for them to swallow. But anyway, they managed to catch enough of fish, and occasionally a bird would land on the raft and they'd snag them and eat them. After 47 days, that's a month and a half, Zamperini and Phil were captured by the Japanese near the Marshall Islands. Mac had died earlier during the ordeal. Their drift covered roughly 2,000 miles, making it one of the longest recorded survival drifts at sea. During those 47 days, they had no navigation tools. After the crash, they lost nearly all their gear. They had no compass, no map, and no functioning radio, just a few emergency rations and two small life rafts. They used the sun's movement to tell direction, roughly east or west. They could tell kind of which way they were going. Not even which way they were going, but they could tell which, of course, where the sun came up and where it went down. But they were driven entirely by ocean currents and wind and slowly pushed westward across the Pacific. At times they thought they might reach Allied-held islands, but they couldn't control their drift enough to aim for any particular direction or landmass. In the end, the current carried them to the Marshall Islands, which was under Japanese control, completely by chance. The title I want to talk about this morning is Why Do Churches Drift? Some of you might think, oh no, we've got to talk about this again. Or why do we need to talk about this at all? I think it's something we need to be aware of. I think it's something that is important, because if we aren't strategic about where we are going, we're going to arrive someplace where we don't want to be. My wife and I like to go to Florida in the winter. And if you would meet up with us going up 522 north someday in February, and you'd say, oh, where are you going? You'd say, well, we're going to Florida. It's like, well, you're going the wrong direction. So I think it's important that we know where we are headed and that we're not drifting like they were on the ocean. They had no way of controlling. They didn't know where they were. They were just floating along. In the Old West, they had cowboys that they called drifters. They just floated from one town to the next, didn't really have any particular goal in mind. If they could find a job, they'd make a little money and then drift on to the next town. Yeah, it's pretty easy for us to live our Christian life that way. We can just float along. We don't get into too many scrapes in life that make us think we can just, or what we sometimes call a bench warmer. There's a book out, I didn't bring it along, that's called Mission Drift by Peter Greer. And he talks a lot about how missions lose their focus And I skimmed through that a little bit, and a lot of very interesting information of why groups lose their focus. But mainly it's because they maybe set out right, but they don't follow the purpose they have set. A quote I'd like to read here in the outset, I'm going to repeat again at the end. You probably heard of it before. It comes out of a poem. It's the set of the sails and not the gales that determine our direction. It's the set of the sails and not of the gales that determine the direction. And typically that, if we talk about back when they had sailing ships, when they depended on the wind direction to get you across the ocean, you could go east or west depending on how you set your sails, no matter which direction the wind was blowing. And if we apply that to our Christian life, we can either go with the wind. I had looked into talking about blowing with the storm, and if you want to look up a fascinating thing, is look up maritime navigation. It's amazing to talk about how you can either outrun a storm or you anchor in a storm. I never realized that there's anchors that you can put out that actually, I always thought an anchor goes down and it latches to the ocean floor. They actually make anchors that are almost like a parachute. And you can either put it out of the back of your boat or out the front, and it will literally hold you in place in the ocean during a storm. It's interesting how, and you could use a lot of analogies with that, but I'm not really gonna get into any of that. So anyway, I think it's important for us to think about, you know, the world is always changing. No matter what era of time we're in, there's winds of change blowing. And I think we need to be aware and have a goal in mind where we're headed so we don't get blown off course. So what causes drift? I'd like to look at some verses in Revelation 2 where the angel is talking to the church at Ephesus. And in verse 4, so he goes down through the list and he talks about the church at Ephesus and how faithful they are. They can't abide sinners and liars. And, you know, they've been faithful during suffering. But in verse 4, he says, "Nevertheless, I have somewhat against thee, because thou hast left thy first love." And I'd just like to look at that verse a little bit. Does that apply to us at all today? Have we left our first love? The NLT says in the bottom there, it says, "You don't love me or each other as you did at first." And I think it's a sign of a church drifting is losing our love for God. You know, we can still be doing a lot of things right. We can still be having a good brotherhood. But, you know, they were faithful, but they started losing that love. Not only for God, but for each other. Now we might say, well, it doesn't apply to us. We're really focused on loving each other. We're working together. You know, we have meetings and men get together, the women get together. And I'm not saying we don't. But I have an item that I'd like to discuss a little bit. It's food for thought. Is the holy kiss related to loving each other? I'd like to ask you men a question. If you tell your wife, "I love you," you believe you love her? Now, I know I'm treading on dangerous ground. I might get ridden out on a rail and tar and feather, as they say, but I've grappled with this. And, you know, over the last 2 or 3 years, we have really become lax in that as a church. And I kind of had my eyes open at Kingdom Fellowship weekend. I think it was Kinley Coulter maybe talked about it. But he said, you know, we as Anabaptists are pretty strong on the head covering. You know, so what 1 Corinthians says is we believe that. It's one chapter. You know how many times the holy kiss is mentioned in the New Testament? I would have guessed maybe once or twice. He said, if it's mentioned twice, maybe it's important. What if it's mentioned 3 times? How about 4 times? Or 5 times? So it's the Apostle Paul mentioned it 4 times and Peter did it once. Question I have, is losing the holy kiss a sign of drifting? I think we need to ponder that. You might say, well, it's awkward. And yeah, I'm sure we've all been in awkward situations, but I think there's ways to overcome that. It says, greet one another, greet all the brothers. You obviously men among men and women among men and women. If it's an expected practice, hey, you're a brother or you're a sister, then it doesn't become awkward because it's expected. Now, some people might say, well, it's just a practice I had back then. Isn't that the same thing to say about the head covering? It was just a practice back then. And, you know, some Middle Eastern cultures do it 2 or 3 times. It's left side, right side, and I'm not sure where to go from there, but, you know, and I'm sure we've all been in situations where it kind of felt unsanitary. Somebody didn't make sure they wiped first. I mean, hey, you know, it doesn't say it has to be on the lips. I mean, just getting frank, practical. It can be, I think, cheek to cheek can be considered a holy kiss. You know, I've grew up in some settings where they were pretty strong about got a kiss on the lips. Yeah, I guess if that's what you want to do, it's fine. But, you know, but I just challenge you to think about it. You know, if we are really serious about that, we claim we love each other, do we show it? You know, like I mentioned, with husband and wife, for children, if we tell our children that we love them, but we don't show it, do we really love them? Okay, just one item to think about. The other thing I think is a sign of drift is worldliness. Now, what is worldliness? Now, it's pretty easy to start thinking first thing that, well, when we think of worldliness, first thing is dress. Well, it's a lot more, it's part of it, but there's a lot more involved in that. What does worldly actually mean? 1 John 2:15 and 16, this is just verse 15, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Sounds pretty serious. If we love the world, the love of the Father is not in us. So I think we better make sure we know what loving the world is or isn't. Recently I was reading a book about Thomas Edison. I'm sure you all heard of Thomas Edison, famous inventor. We had a picture of a young lady, and it said this was his future wife. And it listed all her qualities. She was highly educated and went to a ladies' finishing school and traveled Europe. And at the end it says she was refined and worldly. Okay, well that was supposed to be a compliment. So she was wise in the ways of the world, is the way I took it. Those of us that have Anabaptist heritage, I think we all kind of understand when we talk about somebody being worldly, somebody that maybe didn't grow up in our circle, somebody that is part of the world, it's usually used more as a general sense. So does that automatically mean that, you know, if people aren't part of us or Anabaptist, that they're part of the world that we should love? I don't think so. I think the world is, or let me back up. One way we can see whether or not we love the world, I think, is by where we spend our time. We tell our wife that we love her, but we never spend any time with her. She's probably going to say, your words don't mean anything. So, if we say we don't love the world, but we are focused on self, you know, it's so easy. You know, I think Grant mentioned about youth growing up in this generation, or Curtis, you know, it used to be, if you wanted to go find entertainment, mainly you had to go find a TV somewhere, that kind of entertainment, because that was a big thing back in the 60s. But anymore, that TV and everything else, entertainment, has morphed into this device here. And we can do a lot of good with it, but it can also be a detriment to us. So where are we spending our time? We are entertained to death. And the thing about entertainment, too, is a lot of times we use that to distract ourselves from really thinking. And recently I saw a short clip that somebody had posted, some Harvard professor talked about in relation to how important it is to be bored, because that's when creative thinking happens. Something to keep in mind. Kingdom Fellowship weekend, and one of the prayer groups, Harry Argo was in one of those groups, and you probably all heard of him or even heard him speak. But he said, I think he grew up in a Catholic setting, but it was in Virginia. He said growing up they had a very regimented life. They would always dress up for dinner, and they had their ritual they followed. So it was family time, and he said their dad would always repeat at every meal. He would repeat what their history was. I think he came from Ireland, maybe, I'm thinking, but he knew his history. He said that all lasted until the one-eyed monster showed up, which was the TV. And he said all of a sudden we were all glued to that and things went haywire. What we admire, we will become like. You know, we have social media. Social media bad? I think it can be bad or good, depending on what we use it for. And we talk about social media influencers, people that have millions of followers because they influence people. Are they influencing us? What type of influence is that? And I think we underestimate the amount of influence we have on our lives through all the technology and media. What about political leanings? Political leanings. You know, we talk about the two kingdom concept. The church is separate from the world. And the government is not part of the church. And we as Anabaptist people believe in that two kingdom concept, that God instituted the government to run the world, and the church is completely separate from that. We cannot be part of the church and be involved in politics. Do we believe that? Recently, after the Charlie Kirk was killed, I heard a lot of comments from Anabaptist people, and maybe I was hearing them wrong, but there was a lot of admiration for Charlie Kirk. Now, I admit he was very instrumental in getting people to think, you know, going to college campuses and getting people to understand where they're headed. But he was a political activist. He was all about getting people involved in government, all about getting people involved in voting. He didn't believe in the two kingdom concept. I came across one video where somebody asked him, what do you do about the verse in that Jesus told his followers to love their enemies? And well, he went back to some verse in the Old Testament of why you should get rid of your enemies, or why you should fight. So I think it's important that we are thinking about those things. You know, I don't know how many of you know much about the Prohibition movement. Back in the 1920s and early 30s, a bunch of people got together, and the women were actually a big push in this, to outlaw all alcoholic drink. You know, if we could just shut down all the bars and we wouldn't allow anybody to sell liquor, we could cure a lot of problems. You know, people had problem with drinking and, you know, destroyed families. And eventually they got laws passed. I think it was for about 13 years, there was a law on the books that you weren't allowed to produce, sell, or consume liquor. I might have been able to consume it. We weren't allowed to produce or make it. Well, guess what? It all went underground. And it became a racket. Did they cure anything? No. So it's rare that getting involved in political, I don't know if any situation where people get involved in political movements cured any of the world's evils for any length of time. So I just challenge us this morning. Our job is to evangelize as the church, not get involved in politics. Third and last item is Anabaptism. So we were over in Switzerland for a week and a half, and this is a picture in Zurich. I'm reading the plaque where Felix Mons was drowned along the Lamont River. It was actually a surreal experience to stand there and think, remember, 500 years ago, a man was drowned that stood up for what he believed was right. The kind of pinkish house there on the left is, they believe, where he lived with his mother. And that's basically only a block from the Grossmünster Church, which the two spires there in the background is where Zwingli was preacher. You know, we just came out of a quarter where we studied Anabaptist history. And we looked at the good things and the bad and the ugly. And there's some ugly things in the past Anabaptist history. You know, we looked at the Munsterites and how they took over a city and promoted polygamy. And they were considered Anabaptists. And Anabaptists for years lived under that stigma. And they tried to get rid of that Anabaptist connotation. Or as the translation was, rebaptizer. Today, we wear that Anabaptist name almost as a badge of honor. Incidentally, more so than Mennonite. Mennonite kind of has this thing, I don't know if I want to be viewed as a Mennonite. I'll be an Anabaptist. The reason I'm saying that is, do we understand our history? Recently heard a quote made by Brandon Beiler that I thought was interesting. I'm going to repeat it here. You may not agree with this, but I think he's onto something. He said, "You should choose the conservative Anabaptist way of life because it is possibly the closest representation of credible kingdom living in the world today." Repeat that. You should choose the conservative Anabaptist way of life because it is possibly the closest representation of credible kingdom living in the world today. Now, not meaning that other people out there aren't saved, but he said the conservative Anabaptist lifestyle is a vehicle that helps you get to your destination. Is kind of another way of looking at it. It has also been instrumental in multi-generational faithfulness. Again, that was a quote from him. But isn't our concern about whether we are drifting or not more to do with the future than where we are today? Because I don't think it's as much of a case where we find ourselves today, but again, back to whether I'm going to Florida or not by heading north, is which direction are we heading? And will there be a faithful church in the future for the next generation? Some of the things that we sometimes run into is, well, this conservative lifestyle was maybe used as a weapon in the past on us, so we have a reaction to it. And I don't dispute that some of us may deal with that. But at the same time, if we are reacting, I think we all know that if we're reacting to a situation, usually we tend to overreact and go to the other side. So if there is anything about conservative Anabaptism that makes me react, maybe I should take some time to ponder why that is and work through that. If somebody is always bringing up the things that they've faced in the past and using that as an excuse why I shouldn't or why I should run away from that, they're not dealing with the root issue. Maybe it was authoritarian rule. You know, some of us come out of situations where it was pretty strict rules in place, and you know, maybe what the bishop or the preacher said was law, and it created a bad environment. But we need to work through that. Invariably, as part of the Anabaptist, conservative Anabaptist, eventually we get to the close part, and none of us like to talk about close. Or we don't like to think about why are we always talking about clothes. But at the same time, I just remembered this. This was another comment that Brandon Byler made. Clothes is probably the most intimate part, or most often, I should have wrote that down, but basically you interact with your clothes more than anything else you do in your life. I mean, that's a fact. And so, are clothes important? Absolutely. And how we view clothes has a direct bearing on, I think, whether we're drifting or not. You know, some of the reaction we have is back in the early 1900s, because of the mass production of clothes that came into existence, it was all of a sudden easy to buy fashionable clothes, clothes that were in style for cheap. Before that, you had to make your own stuff. And, you know, so the church didn't, I don't think clothing was as much of an issue before that time. And so then sometimes we say, well, why didn't they talk about clothes back then? Well, that's part of the reason why. And so they instituted regulations to try to counter worldly fashions. Now, did they go overboard, or did they focus too much on one thing? Possibly. When you look at, you know, we talked about the how fast that the clothing left, the plain clothing left in the 70s. I think part of it was related to too much of a focus on one and not also on the spiritual side. Two items I want to point out here yet. I just want to talk about the plain suit and the cape dress. So why? What's with the plain suit? Does that save us? No. But again, I come back to a question that Kinley Coulter asked, which I thought was good. At Kingdom Fellowship weekend, he said, yeah, that plain suit does not save you. Really doesn't have that much significance. But if it's laid aside, what replaces it? And I think the answer to that will tell us whether we're drifting or not. Do we lay it aside for something that is more fashionable with the world? You know, we've, as a church, documented that we want the ladies to wear a cape dress. Now, does that fix all immodesty issues? Absolutely not. We can make a cape dress immodest. But let's look at the principle behind it. How are we making our clothes? It's always interesting as a group progresses. I think you all know what I'm talking about. You look at groups that are more progressive than we are. Isn't it always interesting how the more progressive they become, the more skin is exposed in the ladies? If you never noticed it, I encourage you to pay attention. What does the world flaunt in the women? It's exposing the bodies. Because, well, I think you'll understand the appeal that, sex appeal that the female body has. I'm just asking, are we considering that? That is a sign of where our sail is set. Now, I'm not just going to beat up on the women. I'm going to pointed the guys a little bit. So the term modesty, sometimes a lot of times I talk about modesty, we think right away, women. No, I think modesty has the idea of not drawing attention to myself. I think that's a fair statement. So us as guys can be guilty of drawing attention to ourselves too, how we dress. Our guidelines state that the fellows are allowed to wear t-shirts for work-related, appropriate t-shirts for work-related activities. Well, I think maybe the whole deal with the t-shirt is it'll have enough of a shirt tail on it to keep the shirt in, and guess what shows up when the shirt tail's out? If our women would walk around like that, we'd consider them extremely immodest. So I guess just for the guys, if you're clothing underneath is showing out, I propose it's a modesty problem. Is it a sign of drift? I'll let you answer that. What about vehicles we drive? Right now, the thing is, to have that diesel truck with big wide tires sticking out the side, the smoke's black. So, are we drawing attention to ourselves, or are we pointing people to God? I heard a statement recently that I like to counter, and maybe I'm misquoting this, but it felt like the idea was this, that you can't be a conservative church and care for the hearts of people at the same time. I would challenge that statement. I think we can, if we appreciate our history and where we came from, I think we are able to be a conservative church that avoids drift and still care for the hearts of people at the same time. I think the early Anabaptists did that. Because if we don't believe that, if we think we can't do both, I propose that we are reacting to something in our past. All right, I need to bring this to a close. There are some guarantees in life. There will always be hardship. There will always be temptation. There will always be people who mistreat us. And there will always be drift. As Peter Greer said, drift is pervasive, which means everywhere, but it is not inevitable. Sorry, I forgot I had this picture. The picture on the left is the courthouse where they made an edict that they were going to eradicate all Anabaptists from Switzerland. We literally walked in that door, looked in the building, they had some meeting going on, and I didn't realize what the building was till afterwards. And the lower right here, to the right of the church steeple, is that same building. So I come back to the quote I made in the outset. It's not the gales, but the set of the sails that determine our destiny. Somebody said something about our youth are growing up with AI. AI produced that picture for me. I don't know if there's actually a picture out there like that, but I said I want a picture. I was looking for the who said that, who quoted that phrase or who came up with that phrase, and it asked me if it should produce a picture for me, and it produced me a picture. So again, technology has good uses, but it also has bad uses. So in closing, I'm going to read the poem that Ella Wheeler Wilcox wrote. One ship sails east and another west, by the self-same winds that blow. 'Tis the set of the sails and not the gales that tell the way we go. Like the winds of the sea or the waves of time, as we journey along through life, 'tis the set of the soul that determines the goal and not the calm or the strife. My challenge for each one of us this morning: what is the set of my soul today?